This podcast of Word of Mouth is sponsored by
Dartmouth Hitchcock,
creating a new model for healthcare,
where leading health systems collaborate to improve care for all of us.
A sustainable system
improving the health of our communities
for years to come.
Information at imagine.d-h.org.
And Doucet Survey,
serving your professional land surveying and mapping needs in New England,
now with offices in New Hampshire and Maine.
Information at doucetsurvey.com. That's doucetsurvey.com.
Word of Mouth.
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 Word of
Mouth.
Word of
Mouth.
This is Word of Mouth from NHPR. I'm Virginia Prescott. About 16 years ago, Jessica Leahy was a newly minted teacher who discovered that a student had lifted full paragraphs of text off the internet and put them into her school paper. Jessica called the child's mother in to tell her that she'd be initiating disciplinary action. I'll let her pick it up from here. What happened?
Well, I called the mother, and she was concerned, as any mother would be. But more than that, she was upset, and she said, "You can't discipline my child. She didn't write the paper; I did." And which meant not only was she writing her daughter's paper, she was plagiarizing her daughter's work with stuff from the internet. And I'm not really sure how I'm supposed to deal with that as a teacher.
Well, now Jessica Leahy is an educator, speaker, New York Times columnist, and a contributing writer at The Atlantic. She's taking aim at the coddling, competitive helicopter parents who would do just about anything to assure their children's success and minimize their disappointments. Her new book, The Gift of Failure, How the Best Parents Learn to Let Go So Their Children Can Succeed, draws on her experience and supporting research showing that overprotective parents make for risk-averse, dependent adults. And Jessica, congratulations on the book.
Thank you so much.
Welcome back. It's great to have you with us.
Thanks.
Now, in the introduction, you do write, "We have taught our kids to fear failure. How?"
When I first started writing this, I was at first incensed by the overparenting and the coddling and the paving the way. But really what I became more worried about was the effect of that, the effect that kids end up really worried about making mistakes. They're worried about failing. They're worried about anything that's not perfection right off the bat, because they know that as where their parents are concerned and where colleges are concerned, every point counts. And there just isn't room to make mistakes anymore.
Well, you bring us through this historical kind of record of how children were regarded from they should be seen and not heard in the colonial era. Then we get the parenting experts of the early 20th century and Dr. Spock
right.
in the 1950s. When did children's self-esteem become a motivating force in parenting?
Well, that came in the late 60s, early 70s, when people were working so hard to create this sort of force field of self-esteem around their kids, thinking that if we told them they were wonderful enough that, you know, any insults or injury would, you know, boing off like we had put a protective force field around them. And that's just not, it's not how it works. And as many authors have shown, it didn't quite turn out that way. We've set up our kids to feel really, really confident, but not particularly competent. The confidence aspect of things doesn't have anything to do with experience. We don't let our kids have the experience to become competent. And therefore, they end up with these empty shells of, oh, well, my mommy or my daddy thinks I can do this and I'm fantastic. But there's no real experience to back that up.
So the message to kids is, you're great, but you also don't know what you're doing? I mean, I don't get it.
You're brilliant, you're talented, you're wonderful, you're creative. And kids walk out into the world thinking that they shouldn't be experiencing any difficulties where these things are concerned. If they're, for example, if they're really great at math from kindergarten on, then, you know, everyone's going to come up against a place in math where it gets hard. You know, I talked with Steven Strogatz, who's a math professor at Cornell, and he says it gets hard for everybody, even, you know, a PhD in math. And so when these kids run up against those difficult moments, they then think, oh, no, I better not tell anyone. I better not show that I have any challenges here. No one's going to think that I'm smart, talented, wonderful, whatever. These labels that we put on kids of gifted, talented, brilliant, you're so wonderful all the time, are as damaging as some of the negative labels that we put on kids.
But like the mother who plagiarized for her daughter, I mean, she's well-intentioned.
Right.
She wants her to do well. And we are in this cutthroat environment, you know, pretty much from the time that kids are toddling to when they do their college SATs and applications, they are in fierce competition
right.
with each other to get placement. So it's pretty hard to drop out of that. You know, if you're just one person, what kind of advice do you have to parents who think, I don't want to be in that rat race anymore? How do I do it?
I really think the best way to approach that is to think long term instead of short term. When we're thinking short term about our parenting, we're thinking about making our kid happy now. We're thinking about what will help us, help for the grade tomorrow. If the kid forgets their homework, leaves it at home on the table, and I take it to them today, that will alleviate any suffering they have about the fact that they show up at school without homework today. But it doesn't do anything in terms of their long-term learning, their long-term strategies to prevent forgetting the homework the next time around.
Well, you are talking about a story with your own son. One of your own sons that, you know, he'd worked really hard on this homework and he left without it and you had a struggle. Tell me about how you processed that struggle for yourself. How did you keep yourself from acting?
I was in the middle of writing this book, and I went to Facebook, and I said, lest any of you think this is easy for me, just know my kid's homework is sitting on the table right now, and he worked so hard on it. It's taking everything in me to not jump in the car with that homework. And I actually had an argument with someone on Facebook about it, but when it came down to it, I realized we had just been having a discussion about putting homework in the backpack for the past 2 weeks, actually, before that. And I knew that if I took that homework, it was going to short circuit any progress we've made towards creating a strategy to get the homework in the backpack and have it make it to school. And in the end, that was true. That day, he had to have a conversation with his teacher about strategy. And he and his teacher came up with a strategy that is something he still uses today, which is an index card on the refrigerator with a checklist of things he needs to do for the day. And that wouldn't have happened if I had taken that homework that day.
That's a lot of restraint, I think, in a case like that. But you, this is something that you talk with a parent about because you're a mother and a teacher.
Right.
So you have a couple of different perspectives on this. And there's a point where a mother comes to you and she says that her daughter just doesn't seem excited about learning anymore. And you say the less we push our kids towards educational success, the more they will learn. Now, how do you back that up?
I back that up with the research on intrinsic motivation. The fantastic and brilliant Edward Deci wrote a book called Why We Do What We Do, The Science of Human Motivation. And for us to find our own interest in what we're doing, for us to find flow, that wonderful thing that Mihaly Csikszentmihalyi talks about, flow, where we're engaged in an activity just for the activity itself, not for some end result we're hoping to get out the other side of it. We have to be autonomous, we have to feel competent, and we have to feel connected both to the activity and to the people around us and know that whatever it is we're doing means something to the world around us. And when we're acting only out of an interest in points, grades, in order to make our mom happy, in order to get approval, that's not where true motivation, where intrinsic motivation comes from. That's not how we achieve real flow with whatever it is we're doing. We can't get there when we're extrinsically motivated, either by our parents or grades or teachers or whatever. And the more I saw my students pushed to do things for the product and not for the process, the more I saw them lose interest in the process. Mm-hmm. And for a teacher, that's a disaster.
We're speaking with Jessica Leahy. She writes the Parent-Teacher Conference column for the New York Times, and she's an educator and speaker and now author of The Gift of Failure, How the Best Parents Learn to Let Go So Their Children Can Succeed. Well, that research also built upon some research earlier about rewards. Now, mm-hmm. you're against this. You say ditch the lollipop in your book, against that sort of system of rewards. Tell us more about what is behind that thinking and how we can break ourselves from this. You know, everyone gets a ribbon, even if you're in 13th place.
Right. Anyone who's read Dan Pink's Drive, this will not be news to them. Dan Pink really did an incredible job looking at the science of rewards based on the work of Harry Harlow and Edward Deci. And he talked about it mostly from a business perspective, also a little bit from an education perspective. And there's a great point to be made that, you know, when the SEAL trainer runs out of herring, the SEAL show is over. The sea lions don't act anymore when the herring is gone. And something about when we give primates, in the case of Harry Harlow, when we gave them rewards, their interest in doing the thing, the the trick, the whatever the activity was, in doing the thing for the thing itself declined. Rewards seem to mess not only with motivation, but also with creativity.
So one of the suggestions is have kids help out with household chores. Now, why household chores? What does that do for them?
Well, the bigger picture really is to have goals. One of the things that parents ask me a lot about is, okay, well, this is all well and good, but we still have to deal with test scores. We still have to deal with grades. We still have to deal with things like that. And I say, well, let's make home a place where we're more oriented on process instead of product, and we're more oriented towards personal goals. We talk about it a lot in our family, you know, making goals that employ some sort of risk. And one of the things that people tend to focus on when they talk about goals or they talk about rewards is getting money for chores. And that's something that just doesn't seem to work. If you read a book like The Opposite of Spoiled by Ron Lieber, he talks about that in his book as well. And there's something about being a part of a team, being a part of a family, being part of a class that seems to foster motivation. And in our household, we do things for each other, we do things for our household because they're part of our responsibility, not because we're going to get paid for them.
Yeah, but you talk about your inner monologue, what's going on there. It's faster if I just do it by myself. You know, it's going to take so much to teach him. People are going to judge me. My
right.
house is going to look terrible. You know, my kids are going to look terrible if they're not if they're dressing themselves in
right.
whatever is on the bed or whatever.
Well, I have two stories from this week. There was crusty dishes that came out of our dishwasher, and those had to be redone, and it led to yet another discussion about why the crusty food was on the plate in the first place. And then we had a load of laundry that had to get done twice in our house because it sat in the dryer all night long, and my husband even tweeted out a lovely picture of my older son sitting next to a pile of laundry on the couch because he was steadfastly avoiding folding it. It's not a process of, okay, I change the way things work in my house and overnight we have success. It's a long-term goals are sort of the name of the game here. My kids have learned how to do stuff and then in that wonderful way teenagers tend to do it, have forgotten how to do laundry or forgotten how to load the dishwasher the right way and have gone to school wearing disgusting dirty clothes or mismatched outfits. But that's all part of this wonderful process of growing up, and far be it from me to remove those moments for them.
Well, you mentioned the moment of risk. How do you distinguish what are the great learning experiences and what is something that could, you know, lead them down the wrong path? I mean, it's, of course, not one action is going to be so deterministic, but what's the right way to point?
I think the hard part is sometimes it's hard to know which moments are going to be going down the wrong path and which moments are going to be great learning experiences until you've seen them out. And I think we've gotten into this trap where we're so worried that every single failure is going to lead to some long-term, this is going to go on your permanent record sort of moment, that we're really afraid to take the leap and take the risk with our kid. And there's a story in the book about a mom whose son really was failing out of school, and the school had decided it was time for him to leave that school and go back to his school district school that was far inferior to the school he'd been attending. And the mother came to him and said, look, we're going to go visit that other school and you're going to have some hard decisions to make. Either you engage or I'm going to let you fail out of this superior school and you're going to have to go back to this other school where you're not going to get as much individual attention. And the son, when faced with that decision and when faced with both realities, made the decision to take control of his own work and his own motivation. And it was a real life-changing decision for him. If she had taken over and written his essays for him or taken over and reminded him every single day to put his homework in his bag, he may still be at that superior school, but he wouldn't have learned anything. And he certainly wouldn't have changed in the huge way that his mother reports he has changed since then.
Well, it takes a huge change in parenting. And I wonder if that is something, you know, when you're looking at the long view, someone can read this book and what kind of small incremental
right.
changes you might begin.
Right. There's another story where someone was really upset with me for giving her daughter a B-. And I said in our discussion in our parent-teacher conference that was called with myself and my boss and both parents, and it was all very serious because of this B-. And I said at one point, I said, you're going to have to trust me. This B minus is going to be one of the best things that ever happened to your daughter. They didn't. In the end, that girl wrote about that B minus as being a really important point in her middle school career, a moment when she realized she had to make some decisions about what she valued in herself, the hard work versus the coasting. And, you know, in the end, those parents, you know, if they were to have another crisis with their child, who knows if they're going to remember that moment, but their daughter will. And that's what's important to me.
Well, Jessica Leahy, thank you so much for speaking with us.
Thank you.
Jessica Leahy is a contributing writer for The New York Times and for The Atlantic. She's author of a new book that's coming out next week. It's called The Gift of Failure, How the Best Parents Learn to Let Go So Their Children Can Succeed. And before coming out, it has already been named one of Amazon's best books of the month. There's more in the book at wordofmouthradio.org. This is Word of Mouth from NHPR. I'm Virginia Prescott. Finding balance in a two-income household is tough. Between parenting and jobs and chores and after-school obligations, many working mothers say they lose themselves in the endless swirl of commitments. A group of moms in Maine is working on a way out of that cycle. Katie Ricciardi brings us the story.
Suzanne Quinn never stops moving. Despite working full-time running her own PR firm, the 42-year-old mother still makes all of her family's meals. Tonight, it's Thai pork salad.
Hey, it's one of our staples.
Quinn's son, Jackson, sits at the dinner table doing homework, while her husband, John, makes a phone call. She separates all the ingredients into small white bowls, like they do on the Food Network. Her attention to detail is key for doing well in her professional and personal life. Despite this, she still struggles to find balance.
When you're a working mother, it's so hard because, especially if you work out of your home like I do, you feel like you're failing at both sometimes because you can't give work 100% and you can't give your family 100%. So, I mean, Jackson grew up from a very young age. If I just, like, made the sign on my neck, you know, when I was on the phone, he knew to be quiet.
One of Quinn's friends, Elise Kiley, a real estate broker with two kids, face the same problems.
I think as women, we do so much for so many people that we want to make sure our children, if they're interested in baseball or soccer or football or ballet, we want to do whatever we can to give them unique and different experiences. Why do we not get to do those things for ourselves?
A few years ago, Keely discovered Moms Mornings. It's a club for mothers from all over Maine. You might imagine Moms Mornings as an adult Girl Scout meeting with knitting and cookies. And you would be wrong. A couple months ago, Keely brought Quinn with her to one of the meetings.
We drive up and it was this cloudy, rainy day. I mean, it is raining, coming down.
We were on the verge of saying, let's just go get coffee. And I said, Suzanne, are you going to go home and tell your son and your husband that you didn't go because it was raining?
And sure enough, I got out there and then I realized, funnily enough, it doesn't matter if it's raining when you're surfing because, hello, you're getting wet anyway.
And we had a ball. And She was hooked, line and sinker after that first time.
That's right. The group of moms meets every Tuesday to go surfing in Maine all year round. And they love it.
People look at the surfer like, oh, you have to be this fit, young, hip person. And you can be anyone and get out in there and surf.
Nancy Boutette started the group in 2002, the same year she opened her surf shop, Aquaholics. Like most moms in the group, Boutette started surfing later in life.
I was 36 years old. Our youngest wanted a surfboard for a graduation present from middle school. We got wetsuits and everything like that, and I got a surfboard from a friend, and we all started surfing as a family.
When she tried to buy gear, though, she ran into a problem.
As a woman, when I went into a surf shop anywhere, it was pretty much, yeah, the bathing suits are over there. And then you were kind of ignored. When I first started, actually, if you went in the water, to see another woman in the water was kind of unusual. Now, we go in the water, and oftentimes, there'll be like five girls out and one guy. It's kind of cool.
Boutette is the main reason for the increase in local female surfers. She started Mom's Mornings to get adult women into the water. As a mother of three, she knows that women need an outlet for themselves. This morning, five people show up at the beach, six including me. There are patches of snow from the storm last night. Boutette provides all the gear for free. Winter wetsuits, boards, even parking passes. The suits have hoods and are so thick that everyone moves like C-3PO. Boutette gives a few tips on technique and sends us into the water. Now, one thing you should know about Boutette is that she does not mess around.
Paddle hard! Paddle! Granny, paddle! Paddle, 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 paddle! Nice!
I hit myself in the nose with the board once, missed dozens of waves, and actually got up twice.
My arms are killing me. Feels like I've been paddling through cement all morning.
I smelled like the ocean for the rest of the day, which is one of Quinn's favorite parts about surfing.
I just like having like a reminder of the rest of the day that like I was in the ocean. It's October. People are raking their leaves and I was in the ocean today surfing.
Even though she only started a few months ago, surfing has already changed Quinn's life.
Being a mom and working mom at that, there's always something to do. So you really do have to take that time for yourself so you're a decent person to be around.
For Salt Radio, I'm Katie Ricciardi.
Word of mouth.
Word of mouth.
Word of mouth.
Word of mouth.
This is Word of Mouth from NHPR. I'm Virginia Prescott. Any parent knows that a kitchen full of hungry kids at supper time can be a recipe for disaster, unless, that is, they're helping to make the meal. Despite the dangers of hot ovens and sharp knives, or perhaps because of them, teaching kids to cook imparts a valuable set of skills, like autonomy and safety, and how to follow directions.
Can I dump it in?
Yep. All right, so dump the rhubarb in. Trevor, get the cup measure.
Which one's the cup measure?
Which one do you think?
This one.
That was writer KJ Delantonia coaching her son and a friend on making strawberry rhubarb ice cream. KJ Delantonia is lead editor and writer behind Motherload. It's the New York Times parenting blog, home of the Kids Cook series. And KJ, welcome back to Word of Mouth.
Thanks for having me.
So how did the ice cream come out?
The ice cream was delicious. And you heard Wyatt and his friend Trevor making the strawberry rhubarb compote that we pureed into it. My older son, Sam, made the custard that turned into ice cream. And I'll tell you, I have never sort of successfully made custard. So to coach him to do it with the recipe was really fun and different.
Well, so you've been doing this series with Margot Lasky from New York Times Cooking, alternating posts each week. And now, first, how old are your kids?
I have two 9-year-olds, an 11-year-old, and a 14-year-old. And they've been really pretty much cooking all their lives.
And Margot's daughter is only 3.
Right, and then she has a baby who's just about 1 year. So they cook together, and then the baby, you know, taste tests.
So how, or maybe more importantly, when do you think kids can start helping out in the kitchen?
Well, like Margot, I'd say my kids started at about 3 with me. I might soften butter and give them the butter to put on a garlic toast. So I'd say, you know, here, rub the little bit of garlic on, and now smear the garlic on, and then you sprinkle the Parmesan on, and we put it into the broiler. And that's very exciting because you've actually contributed something to the meal, and it's very simple. And we had a lot of garlic toast. So, you know, pour the pasta into the boiling water. Be careful. Stand back. This is what boiling water looks like. It's kind of amazing how often you need to tell kids things like, this is what the water looks like when it's at a boil. You know, this is what you have to wait for before you put things into the pan. So the sooner you start, even if your child is just standing next to you and maybe doing the bare minimum, the sooner they start to build up that base of knowledge.
What do you think is the value of that base of knowledge?
Oh, we really want our kids to be able to cook for themselves, right? We want them to be able to do it as teenagers when they come home from school. We want them to be able to choose to put together a healthy snack instead of reaching for the first bag of chips that comes out of the pantry. When they move into a dorm, we want them to be able to head over to the dorm kitchen and mix something up if they didn't like what the food was. We want them to move into their first apartments and be able to cook. We do not want them to be like the young Dartmouth babysitter that I once had, and I handed her, you know, a box of macaroni and cheese, and she opened everything and dumped it in the water and then turned on the stove. This is not what you want to raise.
Well, here's a clip of a much more advanced skill set. In this video, you're coaching your 11-year-old daughter, Lily, as she cooks chicken in hot oil. We'll be able to hear she's a little bit nervous.
Hot. Yeah.
because you don't have to be perfectly precise.
Okay, this is really popping up at me.
I know. It's all right.
Now, listeners can't see what happens at the end of this video, which is quite cute. After she screams, she makes a kind of giddy little smile and immediately goes back to taking the chicken out of the hot oil. So is there a lesson there?
She was very proud. Hot snapping oil is scary. That's a very funny recipe. It's called ketchup chicken. She's sauteing is what she's doing. So she's got some hot oil and she's got a lot of pieces of chicken and she's going to very quickly stir fry them. And then we're going to put the sauce, which is oddly made from ketchup, onto them. And so I think for her, you know, she'll often make the sauce or she'll often cut the chicken or something like that. But the sauteing, that is nerve-wracking because the oil can be poppy and the sounds are quite dramatic and you kind of have to be fast and you get it all in. But she was really excited to succeed.
Yeah, I love the pride. In fact, I was just looking at Facebook the other day and a friend of mine, Courtney Esbach Wells, her daughter was cooking and her daughter had made brownies. And the quote is, "Did your mom help you make this?" And her daughter says, "No, she helped me." A wonderful sense of ownership. But a lot of folks, as I'm guessing that you know from your readers at Motherlode, can be quite judgmental when it comes to raising kids and exposing them to any kind of danger. Do you worry at all that having your kids use knives or hot stoves might attract negative comments?
Well, I feel pretty strongly that it's actually safer to teach them how to do it right than to leave them just to figure it out. One thing that I often tell readers that I have been told as I learned to cook is that it's better to have a really sharp big knife and learn to use it right than to try to cut something with a teeny weeny knife that's not sharp enough and you have to saw away at it. You're much more likely to hurt yourself with poor tools and, you know, if you don't understand how to use them.
So that's a good basic. I'm curious about what are some of the good introductory things that Margot's been doing with her three-year-old, for example.
Today we're running a piece about a no-knead bread recipe that we both tried with our families. We had big fun, and really that is perfect for a three-year-old. That is a dump, stir, and wait. Okay, maybe the waiting part isn't perfect for a three-year-old, but the results are really pretty fantastic. She did a watermelon and tomato salad. She had her daughter, you know, learning to dice with watermelon. She actually has a little tool, which we don't have. It looks kind of like a dough scraper, and her daughter's been using that to slice, and she has one for tomatoes too. So she has some special stuff that was perhaps not around when my kids were younger, but it's really helping.
I'm speaking with KJ Dell'Antonia. She's lead editor and writer of the New York Times Motherlode blog about the value of teaching kids to cook. You've heard that phrase, you know, cooking is an art, baking is a science. Do you think kids are better suited to learning one of these skills?
I think people really tend to have kids bake, and baking is great. You learn to follow instructions. Baking is, in many ways, a science. If you don't add your baking soda, obviously you're going to get a terrible result. You really need to weigh and get your measurements right if you want a cake. Some things are a little more forgiving. But one of the things that we're trying to do is not to focus on baking and desserts, which are always fun and easy. And, you know, who's not happy to turn out a pan of cookies? We want our kids to be excited to make the salad for dinner. We want them to be excited to work on the main course, because some of the goal here is, you know, not independent brownie making, which we love, but, you know, real independent cooking. And also, there are really three kinds of cooking as we've been thinking about it. There's following the recipe, which is great. You need to be able to do that. There's following our instructions, which is also great. You need a certain basis of knowledge. But then there's that moment when they can walk into the kitchen and, if nothing else, at least make the box of macaroni and cheese all by themselves, without any commentary for you. You know when the water is boiling. Know that you have to set the timer and you can't forget about it or you're going to end up with sogginess. Know that you want to put the butter into the hot pan so that it melts before you re-add the pasta. I mean, you know, those all sound dumb and simple, but there actually is a little baseline of knowledge that you have to have even to do something as simple as that.
Is there any side agenda here of getting kids to try different foods?
It is a little bit of a side agenda. I think especially for Margot to, to have your three-year-old eating a tomato and watermelon salad. Honestly, we haven't tried the tomato and watermelon salad at our house yet. That's a kind of a surprising combination. So absolutely, when kids are the ones that help make it, they really do get excited about trying it. I mean, we put rhubarb in that ice cream. It was strawberry rhubarb ice cream. And definitely everyone looked sort of askance and they tasted it when it was raw and it's very sour. Sure, it turns into ice cream and who wouldn't eat anything in ice cream? But, you know, trying rhubarb was new. And yes, having your kids be involved in the cooking process does make them more inclined to at least taste it. And in some cases, I think, to be really excited to eat it.
You're doing this in the age of the helicopter parent, you know, those who don't give their kids enough space to work things out for themselves, afraid of any lack of success. Do you think parents today are less likely to let their kids cook than maybe when you were growing up?
Well, I think it's true that, you know, we all cook less, and we often don't think our kids are as capable as they are. If we're cooking less, we also see that as a more unusual activity, something that's more adult, that's more intense, as opposed to just something that sort of naturally happens every day because it has to.
Okay. Do you see a day when the sous chefs are going to take over and you can sit back and let them do it on their own?
Absolutely. I think my 14-year-old could certainly prepare a meal right now. He would probably have questions. There are some things. My 11-year-old could recook that ketchup chicken. She absolutely could. And actually, my 9-year-old daughter made an entire pasta dinner the other day with me, you know, standing over her. I would guess that if we do that, you know, 5 or 6 or 7 more times, she'll be ready. They ought to be able to do it. There's a lot of things that are pretty simple, and we ought to give kids the opportunity to do these things for themselves. And who knows, maybe somebody's going to have pasta with tomatoes for their afternoon snack instead of Doritos.
Okay, we look forward to that. KJ Dell'Antonia, thank you.
Thank you.
KJ Dell'Antonia is the lead editor and writer behind Motherload. That's the New York Times parenting blog. And you'll find links to read the Kids Cook series and see some of the videos by KJ and Margot Lasky at wordofmouthradio.org. This is Word of Mouth from NHPR. I'm Virginia Prescott. Last month, a lost work by a great American writer was published to critical acclaim. And no, I'm not talking about Harper Lee's Go Set a Watchman. I'm referring to What Pet Should I Get? By Theodore Geisel, better known as Dr. Seuss.
I took one fast look. I saw a fine dog who shook hands, so we shook. So I said, I want him. But then Kay saw a cat. She gave it a pat, and she said, I want that.
While you're probably familiar with The Lorax, or The Cat in the Hat, or Green Eggs and Ham, and the dozens of other world-famous Seuss books, there is one chapter of Geisel's professional history that remains relatively unknown. Before he was world-famous for his children's books, Dr. Seuss employed his rich imagination and skillful illustrations for another purpose, convincing Americans to go to war.
He was working on the conclusion to a children's book called Horton Hatches the Egg. The date was June 14th, 1940, and he was listening to the radio.
That's Donald Pease, professor of English at Dartmouth College and the Ted and Helen Geisel Professor of the Humanities.
On the radio, he heard news that Hitler's tanks had moved into Paris. And then shortly after that broadcast, he heard Senator Nye from North Dakota urge the United States to maintain a condition of isolationism.
Americans want no more war. Most of all, they want no more participation in foreign wars.
Dr. Pease says that Geisel was enraged by the paradox of those news accounts and shortly thereafter took a job as chief editorial cartoonist for the New York tabloid PM. Over the next few years, he drew more than 400 political cartoons.
He was primarily focused on two figures, Charles Lindbergh at home, who was a famous supporter, or rather infamous supporter, of Nazi Germany, and an anti-Semite, and Hitler abroad.
In one of Geisel's cartoons, Lindbergh affectionately pats the head of a long sea serpent, which aside from being adorned with a Hitler mustache and decorative swastikas, could have come straight from the pages of One Fish, Two Fish, Red Fish, Blue Fish. And Lindbergh is saying in the caption, "'Tis Roosevelt, not Hitler, that the world should really fear."
He created these caricatures rather quickly because he worked by way of the impulse that news of the day had generated. So he worked by way of the anger that incited him to create the caricatures, the invective, he also needed to meet a deadline. So that work, although it bears some rudimentary relation to the later children's books, doesn't have any of the finish or the framing or the wit or the zaniness that's evident in his children's books.
It's a strange experience looking over these cartoons. Seuss's children's books are often described as timeless, but these strips are anything but, and in some cases, classic Seuss characters are presented completely outside of their familiar context. The Republican Party, for example, is represented in Seuss's strips, as in other political cartoons, as an elephant. Only Seuss's GOP pachyderm looks just like the lovable Horton from Horton Hears a Who.
I meant what I said, and I said what I meant. And an elephant's faithful, 100%.
After Pearl Harbor, he turned to Japanese civilians as well as citizens as a target for his caricatures. And some of the caricatures were quite stereotyped and vicious.
Attention, please. This film, now released for public showing, has been captured from the enemy. It is a typical example of vicious Japanese propaganda.
This series of cartoons also looks vaguely familiar, but in the worst sort of way, like the infamous 1943 Bugs Bunny animated short Tokyo Jokyo or Popeye's You're a Sap, Mr. Jap. Seuss used racist epithets and exaggerated features during this period to vilify Japanese forces and even encourage suspicion of Japanese Americans here in the United States.
But he nevertheless deeply regretted having constructed those caricatures. And as he would explain when he released Horton Hears a Who for publication, the refrain, "A person is a person, no matter how small," was one effort at apologizing to the Japanese people for the demonizing caricatures he'd constructed of them during the war.
So what led Theodore Geisel to turn his back on political polemics in favor of Grinches, green eggs, and truffula trees? The answer, Donald P. says, goes all the way back to Geisel's childhood, when, ironically, he was bullied for his German ancestry.
When he and his sister, Marnie, were walking back and forth from school on Mulberry Street and would be accosted, the year is 1915, by fellow students who would scream, "Let's kill the Kaiser's kid. Let's get the drunken Hun." After the war, he began to understand that the disposition he had internalized to create those cartoons had actually turned him into a mirror image of those boys who had hit him with brickbats when he was a little boy. He was now the bearer of the bricks rather than the target.
It wasn't until 1947 that Seuss got back to writing children's books, but over the next 20 years, he went on to produce The Cat in the Hat, One Fish, Two Fish, Red Fish, Blue Fish, and What Pet Should I Get?, which was discovered in a box and recently published. While some of these stories fall into the category of pure whimsy, others clearly connect Geisel's days as a political cartoonist and his work as children's author Dr. Seuss.
It isn't that he wanted to sacrifice the political import of his cartoons. He couldn't if he wanted to get the war mentality out of the next generation. He wanted instead to foster the love of equality, the desire for peace, a world in which human beings could be in relation to one another, the sense that they were celebrating jointly their freedom.
Sadly, Dr. Seuss's hopes of ending partisanship and mutual antagonism hasn't exactly panned out. After his book The Lorax was adapted into an animated feature in 2012, Lou Dobbs of Fox News lambasted the film as anti-business propaganda.
The movie, set to be released nationwide next month, is about a woodland creature who speaks for the trees and fights rampant industrialism. So where have we all heard this before? Occupy Wall Street.
That reaction led Comedy Central's Funny or Die to produce an animated short called The Conservative Lorax.
Now, I am the Lorax, and I speak for free markets. So why are you making the Thneed industry targets?
I'm trying to take care of the truffle trees.
For now, Seuss's newly discovered, posthumously published work, What Pet Should I Get?, does not seem to be drawing any fire. But who knows? Animal lovers can be a pretty passionate group. A big thanks to Dr. Seuss expert Donald Pease for speaking with us for this story. Pease is professor of English at Dartmouth College and the Ted and Helen Geisel Professor of the Humanities. You can see examples of Dr. Seuss's political cartoons at wordofmouthradio.org. And now to a story of a man who played a pivotal role in one of the most beloved children's movies of all time, but kept his involvement secret for most of his life. By the end of his 25-year military career, Donnie Dunnigan was a highly decorated major who received 2 awards for valor in combat as well as a Purple Heart. He says the Marines were a perfect fit for him, as long as no one found out about his past. He and his wife Dana sat down for StoryCorps.
I got a draft notice in 1952. Korean War still going on, and I'm going to do my duty. I think I had 13 promotions in 21 years. As I remember, it was a Marine Corps record at the time.
Did anyone know that you were the voice of Bambi?
During the Marine Corps? No chance. I never said a word to anybody about Bambi. Even to you, when we first met, I never said a word about it. Most of the image in people's minds of Bambi was a little frail deer, not doing very well, sliding around on the ice on his belly.
Mother, look! What's all that white stuff?
It's snow.
Snow?
I am a commander in Marine Corps boot camp, drill instructors, hundreds of recruits I'm responsible for. I just thought to myself, I don't think I want all these young Marines to start calling me Major Bambi, and I kept my mouth shut.
When did your comrades find out?
One Marine learned about it a month before we both retired. I worked for him 3 times, twice in combat, and I'm one of his guys. A major audit was going on the base. I am up to my neck in duties. He called me in at 5:30 in the morning. I will never forget. I go in his office, and he says, Dunnigan, I want you to audit the auditors. I had never said a disrespectful word to this man in 20 years. I said, General, when do you think I am going to have time to do that? Then he looked at me, pulled his glasses down like some kind of college professor, and there's a big red top secret folder that he got out of some safe somewhere, had my name on it. He pats this folder, looks me in the eye, and says, you will audit the auditors, won't you, Major Bambi?
So how has your life been different than you imagined it would be?
Oh, golly. Well, I have some holes in my body that God didn't put there. I got shot through my left knee. I got an award or two for saving lives over time. But I think I could have been appointed as the aide-de-camp in the White House. It wouldn't make any difference. It's Bambi that's so dear to people. But I love it now when people realize this old jerk is still alive and was Bambi. And I wouldn't take anything for it. Not a darn thing for it.
Retired Marine and voice of Bambi, Donnie Dunnigan, with his wife Dana at the StoryCorps in San Angelo, Texas. Their story will be archived at the Library of Congress. Thanks so much for your listening time today. There's much more to hear and to explore at wordofmouthradio.org. That's where you'll find the Word of Mouth podcast. You can also sign up for it by searching Word of Mouth NHPR in iTunes. And if you like it, write a review or pass it along or tell a friend about it. After all, the best suggestions travel by word of mouth. I'm Virginia Prescott. We'll be back tomorrow, too, with more Word of Mouth here on New Hampshire Public Radio.
Word of Mouth is produced by Taylor Quimby,
Logan Shannon,
Molly Donahue,
Megan Tan,
and senior producer Maureen McMurray.
Our intern is Fiona Shea.
The views expressed in this program are those of the individuals
and not those of NHPR,
its Board of Trustees,
or its underwriters.
Word of Mouth is a production of New Hampshire
Public Radio.